center is not a good recommendation. That's the problem. And actually, there's a related problem. We had a fellow here about 2 years ago. He was here for about 6 months, and then he asked to speak to me privately after being here 6 months. So I went to the office of him, and he said, let me get this right. You taught philosophy, right?
Yeah.
Mathematical logic?
Yeah.
And you believe in miracles? Really? How could you do that? How could you believe in miracles? So I said, I don't know. You know, it just seems easy. I don't feel like I'm making a big effort. Just, but you know, that's against the laws of nature. How could you believe in anything that's against the laws of nature? Well, I'm very careful to keep out of the way of the police. I'm breaking the law. So anyway, there seems to be this feeling that there's nature, and nature has laws, and because nature has laws, then there can't be any miracle. It just can't be. It's impossible. So I want to work on both of those problems simultaneously. Now, I think we have here a very naive picture of what nature is and what cause and effect is. All the more pity, because philosophy has known for almost 300 years that this picture is naive. And we take account of what philosophy itself says, I think the objections just evaporate. They just evaporate. This really is due to David Hume. David Hume offered a critique of causation from which philosophy has not yet recovered. Every year new books come out trying to explain causation and deal with Hume's critique, and one of the main things that Kant tried to do was answer Hume's critique. For a few decades they thought he had it, but then it went to pieces. And today it's a mess. Now here's the idea. Let's think about cause and effect. Someone throws a rock at a window, and the rock comes in contact with the window, and then the window shatters into pieces. You can imagine taking a videotape of this. You see the rock arcing into the window. You can slow it down and go frame by frame. And it touches the window, and the window probably starts to bulge a little bit before it reaches the limits of its plasticity. And then you see it disintegrating into shards, you know. Now we say, well, you see, it's the contact, the impact of the stone that broke the window. Now suppose I point out, this videotape has sound, just at the moment that the rock came in contact with the window, the grandfather clock on the side struck the half hour. Bong. Just at that bong, the window started to strain and then break. So I say, well, why do you say it was the stone that caused the window to break? Maybe it was the bomb that caused the window to break? Now, Hume considers the following line of reasoning. You know, when you have a cause and effect, when the cause happens, and then the effect happens, it's not just an accident. It's not just an accident. Once the cause happens, the effect has to happen. The cause forces the effect to happen. I could say the cause causes the effect to happen, but that would be very illuminating. The cause necessitates that effect to happen. That was Hume's favorite word, necessitation. So between the stone hitting the window and the window going to pieces, there's this bridge, this relationship, that the stone hitting the window forced it, necessitated it to happen. The bong doesn't do anything to the window. It just happened to happen at the same time, but the bong not pushing the window to go to pieces. Aha, says Hume. So you're telling me that in a real cause and effect, there are three things. There's the cause, which is one event. There's the effect, which is another event. and then there's the bridge. The forcing and the necessitating bridge between the cause and the effect. And when you have a phony case, like the bong, you have a bong, and you have the window going to pieces, but there's no bridge. There's no bridge. There's nothing in between the bong and the break that makes it necessary, that necessitates the break, that forces the break from the bong. That's the difference. In other words, if you look more closely, examine more closely the inner workings here, you should be able to see, in the case of the stone and the break, a kind of inner connection, where with the bond and the break, you're not going to have it. Okay, says Hume, let's consider our resources for doing this inspection. We're going to inspect it more closely, more intimately, more anatomically. We'll run the frames one by one. We'll look at each frame for 5 minutes. What are we looking for? Blue sparks, you know? A gray gas? What kind of thing is it that's supposed to do the connecting? Now, says Hume, there are only two things in the human mind that enable us to discover facts. One is observation. Open your eyes. Use your fingertips, your nostrils, your tongue, your ears. Look at the world. Observe the world. Empiricism, right? Experience teaches me what's going on. One way is to open your eyes and look at the thing more carefully and see what you see. That's one way to discover facts. The other way to discover facts is to think. Logic, mathematics can teach you things without ever looking at the world. You don't have to look at the world at all. And you can just think and prove theorems about how things are, at least how mathematical things are, without looking at the world at all. These are the two ways that we know things. By looking and by thinking.
So experimentation is part of observation?
Yeah. Because at the end, you do have to look at it. See what happens, right? Now, says Hume, if you'll take these in turn, take looking and take thinking, you'll see that neither of them can discover this bridge. Neither of them reveals to you the bridge that's there. Let's take looking. So now, remember, the stone arches and it comes in contact with the window, and the window bulges a little bit, and then it starts to go into pieces, and you know, the shards float to the floor. Now, suppose you slow it down. Suppose you look at it frame by frame. What are you going to see? Well, each frame gives you the stone a little closer, a little closer, a little closer, a little closer, until finally you get a frame where the front edge of the stone is in contact with the window. Next frame, it's pushing into the window. Next frame, the window's bulging out a little bit. The next frame, I mean, it doesn't seem that by looking closer and closer, you're going to see anything else other than the arc of the stone, contact, and break. The extra thing, the forcing, the necessitating, the causing, the bridge between the cause and the effect, doesn't seem to be there in what you can see with your eyes. Or touch with the fingertips. Well, let's try thinking. Let's try thinking. We just imagine in our mind the idea that a stone is being thrown at a window. And it's going to come in contact. Now stop there. Now think. Figure out with pure thought what's going to happen. Suppose you've never seen this happen. You're a visitor from the interior of Australia, you know, the bush. And you see these windows. These transparent things sitting in the window frames there. Listen, I want you to figure out for me. I mean, these people haven't seen windows, but they're very bright. They're very smart. You know, we're going to throw a stone, and the stone's going to come in contact with it. What do you think will happen then? Without ever having seen it. What could he possibly figure out? Well, maybe it'll bounce off, or maybe it'll go to pieces, maybe it'll stick there, or maybe it'll break, or maybe it'll bubble, or maybe, you know, it'll attach like glue, and, you know, stay there. How's he supposed to know what's going to happen? Just figure it out by pure logic? Now, if you take pure sodium, which is a solid, and put it in water, it explodes. You'd never guess that. It just looks like a lump of stuff. You know? How would you figure out it's going to explode? Unless you saw it once, and then you wouldn't do it again. Right? So, says Hume, this bridge you're talking about, I don't think you can see it, and I don't think you can logic it. I don't think you can figure it out with pure logic. And if those are the only two ways that we have. We're discovering facts, then you are in the awkward position of proposing something that can't be discovered as true. That's usually awkward. You say, I'm telling you what the difference is between the stone and the bond. With the stone, there's a bridge. And with the bond, there's no bridge. And then I ask you, well, how do you know about the bridge? I don't know. Can't guess. No. I have no way to explain to you how I know about this bridge. You know, that just is not very convincing. Says Hume, you're making a fundamental mistake. The difference between the stone and the bond is not inside. It doesn't require a closer look at what's really going on here and now. The difference between the bond and the stone is outside. Outside. Elsewhere. Elsewhen. Other places and other times. The difference is this. That every time you throw a stone at the window, appropriate direction, appropriate force, the window goes to pieces. Windows go to pieces. Whereas clocks bong all the time in rooms and the windows all go to pieces. Don't look more closely at this event. Look outward at other similar events. And that's where the difference lies. The stone breaking the window means simply that whenever you repeat what here I call the cause, you get a repeat of what here I call the effect. Stones hitting windows cause windows to go to pieces. What's wrong with the bong is that when you look elsewhere at what I'm here calling the cause, namely the bond, you don't find what I'm here calling the effect, namely the windows going to pieces. And that's the difference. The reason I say that right over here the bond isn't the cause is that in other cases bonds take place and there's no breaking of a window. That's what I mean when I say over here that the bond didn't make it happen. The bond wasn't the cause. When I say that the stone is the cause, what I'm saying is that stones in general, hitting windows, are followed in general by windows going to pieces. That's all I mean. All I mean is that the one thing happens regularly and the other thing doesn't happen regularly. That's all I've got. That's all there is in my experience. That's the only way I can tell the difference. Says you, that's all with me. There's nothing more to it. Causation just means things that happen regularly. When I say that something isn't a cause, what I mean is regularly it doesn't happen.
Yeah. So it might as well be that the shatter noise breaks the window. The noise of shattering glass breaks the window. It happens every time.
Well, first of all, you could test that. You could record the shattering noise and then play it back and see if the window goes to pieces. But if it were the shatter noise, then that would be good enough. That would be a good enough test. You know, if you break one window, then the next window ought to also go to pieces because it hears the noise. You know, right there. If this one's a big one and this one's a little one, big shatter noise, that'll be enough to break the little one. You know, imagine them in frames right next to one another, and the noise just doesn't seem to do it. But that's how you do it. I mean, how do you check whether A caused B? You create lots of A's, and you look for and wait to see if there'll be lots of B's. That's all. Now, that's devastating. That's devastating. All you have left is just regularities. Regular associations between events like this and events like that. That's all there is. That's what we mean when we say cause and effect. What's a law of nature? A law of nature usually is a statement that this causes that. Under these conditions, that can be expected to happen because one thing causes the other. So laws of nature, I mean, I'm being a little loose here, but you can structure things this way if you want. Laws of nature just statements that this causes that. Now, if all I have in the law of nature is that these things are followed by those things, does that give me a reason to think that it must always be that way? Has to be that way? There can't be any exceptions? Things could never happen differently? Why would I think that? I mean, I'm only saying that A causes B because every time I look, I see A's followed by B's. Huh? And somebody comes in and says, hey, guess what? I found an A that wasn't followed by a B. shall I say, oh, that can't be, it's impossible. Why is it impossible? Until now, all I had was, everybody says that eggs are followed by bees. Now he says, well, what's followed by a bee? Okay. I mean, he might be making it up, right? It might be unlikely because lots of them are, but that's its own reason to think it's impossible. Why would it be impossible? If you thought causes forced the effect, necessitated the effect, you know, shoved it into place, so then you'd have to say that if a cause takes place and the effect didn't take place, gosh, something got in the way of that forcing, that necessity. How did it do that? How could it interfere? And then you might have a problem. How can a miracle take place? You know, a miracle means that the cause was there, the cause was pushing, necessitating the effect, and the effect didn't happen. Well, how could that happen? Then you have to explain how that could happen. But if you admit that cause and effect just means that this is the way it always happens, this is the way we always experience it happening, and then you have evidence that in one case it failed, why would you be so shocked and surprised by that? You know, we have this association of categories, and we thought it always works, and now we find out that it almost always works, but not always. Yeah.
What's the problem in like one state? I just can't formulate the issue that we're trying to deal with.
We're trying to explain what cause and effect are. Intuitively, cause and effect are felt to be. The cause happens, and that makes the effect happen. The effect has to happen. There's no choice in the matter. It's compelled to happen. It's necessitated to happen. That's our intuitive feeling. Once the cause is there, the effect is, you know, wrenched into place. There's nothing, no way you can avoid it. That's what cause and effect means. Now, first of all, that's, you know, philosophy is interested in ideas like that, just to clarify them and see whether they're appropriate or not. Hume's critique is that there's no justification for that idea, because this forcing, wrenching, necessitating, this bridge between the cause and effect can't possibly be discovered by any of our sources of information.
So it's just experience according to him.
So all you have is that things like the cause are irregularly followed by things like the effect. That's the way we've experienced the connections between the events in our world.
But there's no physical explanation, according to Hume.
Well, yes, sort of. I mean, I don't know what you... The physical explanation is too broad a term. There's no third element in between the cause and the effect that shows or is the pushing, forcing, necessitating, wrenching, you know, relationship between the cause and the effect. Instead, when we say that A causes B and not C causes B, how do we distinguish them? Is there something in between, gluing them together? The answer is we look elsewhere. We look at things that are similar to A, similar to C, and see whether they're followed by B's. That's all we do. And if that's the case, I think a lot of the resistance to miracles goes down, because all you have now for cause and effect is that this is the way we've experienced things following each other. And now here's a case where it didn't follow. So what? And why would anybody think that somehow laws of nature make it impossible that there should be miracles? Why should it make it impossible? Laws of nature are just the way things are experienced to follow one another, and in this case, there was one that didn't follow that way.
I think it's when the miracle happens that it's never repeated necessarily.
Okay.
So there's no way to really confirm.
Well, but lots of events are single events. I mean, the Big Bang is a giant king-size single event. Nobody said that science can't investigate the Big Bang because it isn't repeated.
Well, we have the so-called after effects.
Correct, and that's one way to investigate an event which only happens once. What that shows you is an event doesn't have to be repeated. Now, if you have witnesses to an event who can then tell you what happened, that's also a way to investigate an event that happens only once. Indeed, if you narrow it down small enough, each event only happens once, right? Peter murdered Paul. If that happens, it only happens once. Because then Paul's dead. So it's not going to happen again. Other people murder other people. It's not Peter murdering Paul. So how do we investigate Peter murdered Paul? It's a unique event. Only once in all the history of the whole world does Peter murder Paul. That doesn't stop us from investigating it. Not all science is experimental science. Those who are struggling with evolution have worked hard, like Ernst Mayr and others, to explain that there are historical sciences and there are experimental sciences. Historical sciences deal with, you know, the formation of the earth. There are theories about the formation of the earth, even though it only happened once. Okay, now, So I think that should reduce people's resistance to miracles. Now let's go back to the soul. The critic is saying, I can understand how physical objects interact with one another. One physical object causes an effect in another physical object. That I can understand. But a body and a soul, I mean, that's beyond belief. The body is a physical thing, and the soul is a non-physical thing. How in heaven's name could they possibly connect and interact with one another? Well, the truth is now, having Hume on board, we don't know how physical things interact with one another. We don't know how physical things connect with one another. We don't know how they connect with one another. We just see that these kinds of physical events are regularly followed by those kinds of physical events. We don't have any, in a deep sense, we don't have any explanation for it. And we don't have any necessitation for it. We just see that stones hitting windows are regularly followed by windows going to pieces. Raw eggs being placed in boiling water for 10 minutes come out hard. I mean, that's just the way things happen. It's the connections between the events that we experience, the regularities in the events that we experience. But it's no more than that. So for someone to say, well, I can understand physical things causing physical things, but I can't understand the soul of the body interacting, the mistake is to speak about understanding anything. You really don't understand anything. You don't understand how one billiard ball makes a billiard other billiard ball move. You don't understand it. You just observe it. You just see it happen. You see the one billiard ball, the white ball, approaches the black ball, comes in contact with the black ball moves off, and very nicely slips into the pocket. You back up your 6 points, and you know, go on to the next shot. We don't understand it. We just observe it. We observe that regularity. Okay, so then the relationship of the soul to the body is not a matter of worrying how we can understand that this thing and that thing can interact with one another. All we really need is to be able to observe it. But to that, the answer is very simple. We observe it all the time. Watch. There you are. My soul decided that my arm should go up, my arm went up. That's part of my experience all the time. Watch again. I have a sensation in my hands. That is to say, my soul feels a sensation from my hands. So, what the body did caused a response in the soul. I experienced the regularity of cause and effect, the regularity of one event being followed by another event from the soul to the body all the time. I experience it directly and so do you all the time. I have as much or more experience of the interaction between the soul and the body as I do of the interaction between one physical object and another physical object. So if all you need is just to notice it, keep tabs, you know, of these things being followed regularly by those things, then the interaction between the soul and the body is strictly on a par philosophically with the interaction of billiard balls or stones and windows. They're just types of events which are followed by other types of events. Yeah.
Because of what we have observed in physical ways, we have come up with the explanations for it. We still haven't come up with any explanation for spiritual physical.
Good. Okay. Let's look at some of these explanations.
Mechanisms.
Oh, good. Mechanisms. Gears and wheels and fly traps and ratchets, you know, and gears. Okay, let's see. Let's take the growth of a plant. Gosh. You stick it in the ground, you water it, put it in sunlight, and it grows. Now, this is not with this first example, but I'll modify it a little bit. That just happens, you know. Whenever you put the plant in the water, in the ground, with water and sunlight, it grows. That's just, whenever it's under these conditions, that's what it does. These conditions are followed by those conditions, right? But you understand, we have an explanation for this. Under the microscope, we can see cells. And we know that the cells divide. growth is really the multiplication of cells by cell division. That's what happens. You know, you'll set, it's not that the cells get bigger. There's a limit to how big the cell can be. But you make more and more and more of them. That's growth. Now we have an explanation for it. Now listen carefully to the explanation. When there's soil, and when there's water, and when there's sunlight, cells divide. That's what they do. That's what they do. Under those conditions, the cells divide. Yes, sirree. If you watch them under the microscope, you can see them dividing madly over and over again. You know, furiously separating from one another. That's what they do. But you understand that from telling us what the plant does, science moved to telling us what the cell does. What I get is more information of the same type. It's just more information of, under these and these conditions, those and those things happen. Now watch, as we go down level by level, you'll see, you get more and more information, but it's all of the same type. It's always, under these and these conditions, those and those things happen. Well, let's see, the cell. The cell is a gigantic collection of millions or hundreds of billions or more of molecules. Now listen, these molecules have a specific shape, they have certain magnetic properties, and some of them are ions, you know, with extra electrons, or lacking electrons. And molecules, because of their shape and because of their property, whenever molecules of this kind get together with molecules of that kind, there's certain chemical reactions, and certain radicals are exchanged, and the energy levels go up and down, and that's why the cell wall gets bigger and bigger, and this thing gets, and the DNA gets doubled. You know, we have a molecular explanation for the whole thing. Yeah. And what's the explanation built on? Whenever you have molecules of this and this kind, under these and these conditions, those and those things happen. Now, if you go down to the atoms, you go down to the particles, down to the quarks, you're just getting more of, under these and these conditions, those and those things happen. That's all you get.
I understand that. However, we've been able to do that with physical. We've been able to realize the, I guess, classical underlying form and break it down more and more. We've not been able to go anywhere with, or have we been able to go anywhere with spiritual?
So what? But what difference does it make that you've been able to do it?
It shows that we have some, I guess, better understanding.
Well, you have more information of the same kind. Now, more information is always valuable. You now know, given that these things happen in this way,
it's much easier to understand one than the other. It's much easier to accept and say, okay, yes, the physical can interact with the physical, then the spiritual can interact with the physical.
Well, maybe it's easier psychologically, but philosophically, I don't think it makes any difference at all. Because at every level, you are simply left saying, when these things happen, those things happen. And then why? When these things happen, those things happen? I don't know. It just happens that way. At the bottom, that's all you get. At the very bottom, what you get is two electrons. If you push them closer and closer together, there's a repulsive force. Right? So that the closer they get, you have to push harder and harder to push them even closer. Right? Why is that? Don't know. That's what they do. Every time we try it, that's what they do. That's all you get. Pushing them closer gets more force in between them. That's all.
You say that like forces repel. Why? Because that's just what they do.
That's right. That's all you get. You don't get any more from science.
I'm not denying that they would just keep breaking down and getting back to the same.
So what I'm saying is this. The scientific investigation is very fruitful because if you know the different categories that can be expected to follow one another, you can take advantage of them and you can manipulate things in various ways as long as they go to stay stable that way. But that doesn't mean that I have any better understanding of why it is that when this and this kind of thing happens, that and that kind of thing happens.
We know how. Yeah. We don't know why, but we know how.
Well, what we know, let's put it this way. Children, when they're very young, they start to respond to aspects of the world. Their first responses are functional. They learn chair, they learn table, they learn mommy, they learn milk. Things that are functional for them. Much later, 6 months, 8 months, a year, they start learning things like red or round. Because you think of the red things in your environment, there are lots of different ones, and they don't share any functional properties. They're red pencils and red apples and, you know, red ink and red paint and, you know, red earth. So red isn't the functional properties of it. Now, why are we interested in red? Because red things all have certain things in common which associate regularly with certain types of effects. We're hunting all the time for the right categories. We're hunting for the categories where, if I categorize things this way, then, oh, well, that's an A. So because it's an A, we can expect a Q. But if I don't have the category A and I don't have that category Q, I'll never put them together. I'll never know what to expect. So we're hunting for the categories. Now, what science does when it follows smaller and smaller levels is it creates all sorts of new categories and therefore gives us lots and lots of more connections. The more connections you have, the more finely you can grade your expectations to say when one thing will happen and another thing will happen. The more connections you have, the more access you have to manipulating the world. So all that is very valuable. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. I'm just pointing out that philosophically, you still don't get any answer to the question, why is it that when this happens, that happens? You supply the whole mechanism, but at the bottom of the mechanism, what you have is, well, when these things happen, those things happen, which is the same thing that you started with philosophically.
And therefore, that's the reason why one can say that I can understand the words, by him saying, I can understand how the physical interacts with the physical, but I cannot fathom how the spiritual can interact.
No, I don't think that's right. If by how you mean, I understand the connection between the cause and the effect, I can see what it is that links the cause and the effect. I can see what it is that guarantees, that forces, that necessitates, that wrenches, when the cause happens, wrenches the effect into existence and makes it be. No, we never get that. We never get that. Because when you go down to the smallest structure, when you ask how the smallest structure works, all you get is, under these conditions, that happens. Let me put it this way. Let's go back to when we didn't have any of this structure. Were we?
Then be equal.
Well, no, but I ask something else. When we didn't have all the structure, were we really in doubt? You know, plants always have been seen to grow in the springtime when you put them in the ground and you water them and put them in the sunlight, they grow. But you know, we have no mechanism for this. We don't know what the smaller pieces are. We don't know what the conditions are of the smaller. So therefore, maybe next year won't work because we don't have any smaller pieces. And therefore, we can't really trust it. You know, we don't really understand it. We're just guessing. No, I don't think that's right. On the contrary, science is designed to explain those regularities that we're very sure of. We want to know why they work. Right? So it isn't as if the extra understanding gives me more confidence. I was very confident of the regularity in the first place. That's why I wanted to investigate it, to find out why it happens. So what I find out is more about the conditions under which it happens, the underlying pieces. But the question we're dealing with, which is, why is it that when the effect cause happens, the effect follows? Why is that? What's the explanation? What's the glue? What inner understanding do I have of the phenomena that gets me from the cause to the effect? There we always come up empty. All we come up with is, whenever you do this, that happens. Okay, so now with causes, with souls, I'm back at 300 years ago where they were with plants. Don't know anything about cells, certainly not about molecules. Listen, I'm a horticulturalist, and I know you put this plant in this place, it grows. How do I know? Because my grandfather did it, my great-grandfather did it, has been doing it for hundreds of years, and it works that way. You try it, you'll see, every year. Over here it grows, in the sun it grows, in the shade it doesn't grow. You know, when you go to the plant store, they give you these little things, water every 3 days, and put it in the sun, or put it in the windowsill, put it in a dark place for 3 months, and then after. How do they know that? Not by molecular analysis. Not by watching the cells. They know it from experience. And it works. It works because we've experienced it to be connected that way. That's all we have. Yeah.
So the argument is really like, we know like a like mechanism, so to speak, but not literally the ultimate cause. That third thing, the third messenger thing.
Well, your words might be right in what you mean by them, but they could mislead other people who will be listening to them. It's not as if I didn't get to the bottom yet. There's more to go. There are more smaller pieces that I haven't found. It's that on this journey, whatever I find isn't going to help. Because there's going to be more pieces of the same kind. So far as we know, electrons are the bottom of the line. Electrons aren't made out of other things. And we don't get any good explanation for why electrons repel one another. It's just one of their fundamental properties, that they like charges repel and like charges attract. More than that, we just don't have anything to say.
About the spin, right?
The spin's another property.
the idea that when I eat food every day, I know that eventually I'll get the satiation feeling. So,
I guess so.
You know, the argument is that with body and soul, we don't have any trial and error. There's no such thing as trial and error. In physical, we have trial and error.
Well, I understand that. So you have illusions where a person will see something and see it wrongly. The visual experience will mislead him as to what's going on in the physical world. Why?
So that's a analysis of trial and error. Hmm. I've been eluded. I've experienced this illusion, and so I made an error. So let's try this again and see what the real answer is.
That's trial and error with the soul interacting with the body.
Oh, I see.
I think so. You can numb a part of the body. Here's a good example. There are lots of them in good science museums. You take two boxes, one quite small and the other quite large, and ask the person to lift them both and ask which is heavier. Right? It's very obvious that the small one is heavier than the big one. Now, they're actually the same size. But because it looks bigger, your muscles tense in a special way to pick it up. And then it's unexpectedly light for the way your muscles tense. So it feels light. And the small one, you don't have that reaction. So it feels differently to you, even though they're exactly the same weight. So it feels the same, even though it feels differently, but the weight is the same. That's a kind of illusion and trial and error interaction with the soul and the body. I don't see why you can't do the same thing.
The soul is what?
The soul is the thing that's feeling it, and then rationalizing as to, you know, calculating what the weight is. Okay, now, I have about 8 minutes or so. I'll add one idea, which is related. The same David Hume who gave us this critique of causation also produced a famous argument which was supposed to show that you could never have enough evidence to believe in a miracle. This says nothing about whether miracles happen. Maybe they do. But a human being could never have enough evidence to believe in it. It's beyond, it's in a sense, and this is sort of giving the cat away, but it's sort of beyond the possibility of discovery. And here's the argument. Let's suppose 3,000 people came to you and told you something is true. Suppose 14 billion people told you that it's not true. Who would you go with? I hope this is not a hard question. You go with the 14 billion, right? Okay, now he says, here are 3,000 people who say they saw a miracle. Compare that with the sum total of all human experience of nature. Nature functioning according to the laws of nature. That's all their experience before and after the miracle. And all the experience of everybody else in the history of the world. Well, if you count up the experiences, you got 3,000 people with one experience, and you got billions and billions of experiences on the other side of nature functioning naturally. These people say it's a miracle, and those people are saying there's no miracle. Clearly, you have to go with the 14 billion. No matter who you pick, no matter how many people witness this miracle, they're not going to compare like a drop in the ocean against the sum total of mankind's experiences of nature. So there's never going to be enough. Think of it as a court of law. You know, if 3,000 witnesses saying this, and 14 billion witnesses saying that, clearly you would say something wrong with the 3,000. Right? That's roughly Hume. The truth is, this is found in Dialogues of Natural Religion by Hume. There's a whole literature on what Hume must have meant. So it's obviously something which is very much embattled, what he said, and whether it's valid or isn't valid. I'm giving you one run through. Now, think of what I said. Think of what I said. You should be able to see right away, that there's a problem here.
The people didn't say it didn't happen in the first place. So we might as well disregard what they say. That's right.
Number one, you only have to choose between the 14 billion and the 3,000 if they're contradicting one another. The 3,000 say, this miracle happened at this time and this place only. The 14 billion don't say, oh, we were right there with you, all 14 billion of us. And we were watching. And we saw it didn't happen. If that's what you had, then indeed you should go with the 14 billion. What do the 14 billion say? They say, at other times, in other places, the same similar thing didn't happen. They could all be true. They could all. Why am I forced to choose between them? Why can't I accept all of them? In other places, in other times, it didn't happen. At this place, in this time, it did happen. So on the face of it, if there's no contradiction between the witnesses, you don't have to choose and accept all of them. That's if you take it at face value. That the 14 billion is simply saying, in my lifetime, the sea never split. I never saw things levitate. I never heard voices from mountains. I never saw, right? It's just, that's the way the world goes. Suppose we upgrade the 14 billion. They're not just saying, I saw the sea never split. What they're saying is, I see that nature is law-like. I see that there are categories and patterns that are never broken. I see that nature is laws that make things happen one way rather than another way. Now, if they see that there are laws, universal laws, laws that apply everywhere, then there's going to be a contradiction between them and the 3,000. The 14 billion are saying, we see laws that apply everywhere. The 3,000 are saying, we saw that the laws didn't apply over here. Okay, so that's a contradiction. They'd be forced to go with the 14 billion. But of course, the 14 billion didn't see any such thing. They didn't see laws. They didn't see that things have to happen that way. The 14 billion saw individual events. And the best they have is that they saw individual events that fall into certain categories. That's all they have.
But they're making extrapolations, which may not necessarily be correct.
Correct. A witness, you know, there's a thing called in law called drawing a conclusion. You don't allow a witness to draw a conclusion. The witness can say what he saw. He cannot go out beyond what he saw. The minute he goes beyond what he saw, he's offering an opinion. He doesn't have a status of a witness anymore. So, over here, the whole idea breaks, I think, on this simple question. If the 14 billion are telling us what they saw, so then there's no contradiction between them and the 3,000. The 14 billion saw times when it didn't happen, and the 3,000 saw the one time it did happen. And they're going beyond that, they're not credible. Now, as I said at the outset, according to Hume's argument, even if it really happened, you couldn't ever discover it. That ought to be very suspicious. Hume is saying that on the way we accept evidence, we could never have enough evidence to believe in such an event. That doesn't say that the event can't happen. It just says that we can't have enough evidence to believe in it. Is it really appropriate to have rules of evidence set up in such a way that even if the event happens, you could never discover it? At that point, I think you ought to question your rules of evidence. Why would you lock yourself in a box where, even if it happens, I play by my rules, and according to my rules, I could never know it? That's time to re-examine the rules. There's nothing wrong with rules that prevent you from ever knowing something, even if it happens.
But that's what relativity was. With relativity, you change the rules. And when you change the rules, you said, now, based on my understanding of what the real rules should be, I expect to see that, you know, life's going to behave in a certain way, which nobody had ever observed it, because nobody ever bothered to look. And then, once they saw that, in fact, the old rules no longer apply.
Listen, I didn't say you can't change rules. My statement a moment ago was in favor of changing rules, right?
Right.
Okay. Now, so I don't understand why you introduced your comment with but. It sounds as if you're trying to formulate an objection.
No, it's not an objection.
Okay. Furthermore, I'm only talking about changing rules under a particular condition. I'm talking about changing the rules under a condition where, by changing the rules, you make it impossible to know that something happened, even if it happened. Now, you might be forced to do that. You know, if something, event takes place outside my life cone, then, by relativity, there's no way I can know about it. But you only do that if you're forced to. You do that if, you know, experiments show you there's no way to avoid it. You don't opt for it. Here we're talking about rules of evidence, something sort of abstract and philosophical. Well, that's very, very weak. And I suggest that a good argument against rules that make it impossible to discover things is
Then it makes it possible to discover things, not good rules. You've got to change the rules so that you can discover things, or at least re-examine things. There's no way to say, I got my rules. According to my rules, you can never discover these things, so therefore, you can never discover them. That doesn't sound like a good position to have. Okay.